20 years ago, a young adult novel made a huge splash for its treatment of a very tough subject matter, sexual assault. Speak was the novel by Laurie Hulse Anderson. It has been translated into several languages, read all over the world, turned into a movie with Kristen Stewart. Speak is followed 2 decades later by Shout, a first-person account of the author's rape at age 13. It is nonfiction. It is also written in free verse. Laurie Hulse Anderson writes a lot of books, and people read a lot of them. She writes for all ages, and her works combined have sold a reported 8 million copies. Laurie is also an activist for diversity in publishing and against censorship. She lives in Philadelphia and joins us here on The Exchange to talk about Shout. Laurie, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, good morning. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Had you censored yourself before writing Speak, your novel?
Well, it took me 23 years after I was raped when I was 13 to even be able to talk about it to a therapist, much less to the world. For me, it wasn't a question of censoring myself as much as not being able to process and deal with what happened to me and not having the words to talk about it. So the first step for me was getting the help that I really needed. I was dealing with profound depression and PTSD. And then after a while, I figured out a way to transmute part of my story into fiction. Melinda's circumstances are very different from what I went through. To be honest with you, I never thought Speak was going to be published.
Really?
So no one was more surprised about that than me. And somehow I've spent the last 20 years talking about this now.
So why did you think it wasn't going to be published? I mean, people had dealt with other difficult subjects in young adult fiction before.
Not back in the late 90s. I think we've seen a lot of that in the past 20 years. But back then, there was very little conversation about this anywhere, which was, you know, really not my intent. If anything, I wrote the book for myself and then was surprised when a publisher finally said, yes, that sounds like a good thing. And even the publisher didn't think that there was going to be much of a market. They said, well, you know, it'll take 3 years and you might sell 3,000 copies. I think they misjudged the market a little bit. I think that the reception to Speak, to other works that look at the survival of sexual violence, and now to Shout, have proven that our nation is hungry to have these conversations.
You know, Speak has been so successful and, as we mentioned, released in several editions, including a 20th anniversary edition. What clicked in you, though? What got you to think about what became Shout, to tell the story about yourself and not about somebody else?
Oh, I can tell you exactly where I was standing when I had made
Wow.
that decision, or it was imposed upon me. I was in New York City in the fall of 2017 as a bunch of women in Hollywood were elevating the Me Too movement, which had begun a few years earlier. It was started by Tarana Burke, who was a really, really important figure in terms of supporting survival of sexual assault victims. So these women had elevated. They were calling out Harvey Weinstein. But what I was listening to was a podcast that contained information about the immediate misogynistic backlash. Men, you know, doubting women and really being really horrid about the idea that somebody might want to speak up after years after having been hurt. And I was so angry. I don't think I've ever felt rage that intense. And in my rage, I was just lines of poetry were dropping into my head. And that's when I knew that I had to write this book.
Well, that answers the next question then about poetry, but this is how it presented itself to you in your own head.
Absolutely. My father was a poet, and I've grown up writing and really enjoying poetry. But this was the first time it ever was clear to me that I wanted to tell my story in verse. Poetry, it's a very magical form of literature. It's the form that we use when we're either trying to, you know, give somebody a punch to the gut or embrace them and make them feel safe and welcome. And I try to do a little bit of both in this book.
Well, let's see. Here's an example. This book is yesterday's mud dried on the dance floor. The step patterns cautiously submitted for your curious investigation of what I feel like on the inside. Wow. What did you feel like as you wrote this?
It was, you know, a lot of the stories in Shout are things that I've talked to people about, so it wasn't as if this was a grand revelation to me. When I started to speak to high school students 20 years ago, I would go into an auditorium and speak to 1,000 or 2,000 kids. They made it very clear that they didn't want me to talk about the metaphors in Speak. They wanted to hear what I had been through. Our teenagers are hungry for models of survival. Not just our teenagers, our sisters and brothers who are adults. We don't talk about this very much in our culture yet. And so when somebody can stand up and say, this happened to me, this is what it felt like, this is how I processed it, and now I'm healthy, now I'm whole again. So the writing process for me was kind of an affirmation of all those lectures and all those years of talking and finding the right words in the right order to convey to other survivors and other people how much they're valued and worth and how much work we have to do to change rape culture.
So you felt a great responsibility, it sounds like, to other people as you wrote this down.
Oh, absolutely. Always.
But in the process, of course, you're bringing up things that you might not have thought about for a long time or ever, perhaps. I mean, was there a fair amount of catharsis or pain along the way for you in the process of writing Shout?
You know what? The catharsis was unexpected, and I have to give a hat tip to my editor, Kendra Levin, because when I sent her the first draft of the book, I didn't have many of the poems that you see in the finished book about the years immediately after my rape. I was 13 years old when I was raped a few weeks before ninth grade started. And the years that followed that were pretty uncomfortable. I spent most of ninth grade being high as a way to avoid, kind of anesthetize myself. And then I slowly crawled out of this fog of weed smoke and tried to figure out how to be a healthier person. And I had never really looked at those years closely. And Kendra thought that would probably be a good thing to do, and she was right. The catharsis for me was forgiving 13-year-old me for being afraid and for being ashamed and for not asking for help.
Wow, that's the teen who needed the most comfort, it sounds like.
Indeed.
Wow. Lori Halse Anderson, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, her book of free verse about a survivor of, well, about herself surviving sexual assault. The book is called Shout. It's a 20-year follow-up to Speak, her young adult novel of many years ago. You can join the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange when we return, and we'll be back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. On the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are honored to have with us today Lori Halse Anderson, a writer of many books, which have been read by many people. She wrote a book 20 years ago, a young adult fiction book about sexual assault called Speak. It is followed up 20 years later by a first-person book, a reality book called Shout, written in free verse about Lori Halse Anderson's own rape at the age of 13. You can join the conversation on the Exchange about these works and about their meaning to society at large. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Lori, the first full poem in Shout is about your father's World War II experiences stuffed away. Do we store trauma until we can deal with it?
I think we do. I think it's important to recognize that silence is often the choice that people make because it makes them feel safe. If, for example, you're living in the house with the person who abused or who hurt you, speaking up about that can mean violence to an even greater degree. It can mean you can lose your home. It might feel like you're going to blow up your family. And my father, I think, is the example of a generation of veterans, one of many generation of veterans, who came home from war with a lot of really painful baggage. Daddy was with the troops that helped the survivors of the Dachau concentration camp in Germany at the end of World War II. And what he saw and experienced there haunted him for the rest of his life.
Well, you know, I wrote that question about your father before I read the next poem about your mother's silence. As you move through life, have many other people told you about dark family secrets they had kept under wraps?
I don't think I've ever met anybody who doesn't have a dark family secret. It's interesting, when you're in your own family system, particularly as a child or teenager, that's the only world that you know. So you would probably, most people don't think, realize that this is a secret. You just know we don't talk about this. We don't air this laundry in front of others. And it's not until we're adults ourselves that we can look back and go, oh, wow, that was intense. And you know, I look back on my parents and I recognize how big their struggles were and how hard they worked just to keep a life together for all of us. But by then, you're often in your own patterns of silencing. This is, I think, why we turn to art. We turn to art to help us make sense of our own lives and maybe give us some insight into how we can do it better for our own children.
It's kind of like coming outside the lines on the soccer field, because this is the way to get things done. You know, you can't keep following the rules about how things are done. But in art, you can create a world.
Absolutely.
So what was it that your mother had been silent about?
Oh, my mom had a lot of pain. My father was violent with my mother earlier in their marriage. Really hurt her quite profoundly. And they stayed married because that's what both of my parents felt they should do. There was never any discussion of involving the police or getting counseling for my mom. They repaired the damage to her body and moved on. And my mother had habits of silence I talk about in the book that were pretty profound. She dealt with a lot of loss. My mom miscarried 5 babies, and I think mourned for them her entire life, certainly my entire life. I was the first child that survived. I always look back. My mom passed away in 2009. I miss both of my parents so much. And I know that my mother she came of age in the early 50s, and was part of that generation of women just before the feminist movement took off, and had her life taken off track by several bosses who thought that her body was, fair game because she was a woman in the office. And she never really found her voice. So I feel especially honored to be able to speak up for women of her generation as well as mine.
Did you and she ever talk frankly, maybe late in her life, about the things that that she didn't do because of the constraints upon her?
She would talk about things obliquely. My mom was always the boss of the conversation, and when she didn't want it to continue, she was quite skilled at shutting things down. I think that she would have been more comfortable if she had been able to divorce my father. My father adored my mother, but my mother didn't feel as strongly about him. So she lived out her life in a marriage that was incomplete, I think, in a lot of ways. And it breaks my heart to think about the choices that she felt she had to make without recognizing she had a lot more opportunities than maybe appeared at first glance.
Lori Hulse Anderson is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her latest book is called Shout. It's a free verse nonfiction about being raped at age 13, the true story of a survivor who refused to be silenced. And, considering how literate you are and how many people go to you for being literate, I almost laughed out loud to read that you hated reading as a kid. What changed that?
Oh, my gosh, I couldn't stand it. I thought school was horrible. School feels horrible if you're struggling to learn how to read. It didn't come easily to me. I needed a couple of years of extra support with special teachers. Thank goodness for the public school teachers of Syracuse, New York, who were there for me. When I finally did break the reading code, I loved it. I became that kid. I can read and walk at the same time. That's how I got to school back and forth every day. But I think because of those early years of struggling, I never envisioned a career that would be involved with books or writing at all. That wasn't in the cards for me.
A few pages later, after we learned that you hated reading as a kid, we get once you took it up, though, that there's a poem about where you read. Among the Dead. Why?
Oh, we had such a lovely cemetery close to my house when in Syracuse, New York. Beautiful old Victorian, the front section of it was made during Victorian times. And my dad used to go jogging through that cemetery, so it felt like a familiar and safe place. And they had these lovely, this is probably completely inappropriate, but I have to be honest, these lovely flat tombs that the sun would heat up during the day. And I love to read on those tombs.
To be honest, you're not alone. There's a lovely cemetery in Coventry, Connecticut, where I had the same experiences.
Oh, that's fascinating. That's wonderful.
Out of curiosity, Lori, did you write the poems of Shout sequentially?
No. The first poems that came out were the rage poems. The first section of the book looks at my life, the life of my parents, what it felt like to be attacked at 13, and how the good decisions I made, the not so good decisions I made in the aftermath. The second poem, though, reflects my frustration and anger with a culture that still does not provide safe spaces for survivors, doesn't, you know, really disputes survivors of sexual violence when they speak up. And also, we keep on churning out generation after generation of victims simply because we lack the courage as adults to speak openly, honestly, and consistently to our children about the need for consent-based sexual activity.
It does seem like we lose a whole lot of opportunity by just being uncomfortable and talking about the subject matter in the first place.
Absolutely. And let's recognize that very few of us had parents who could talk about it either. We're looking at a culture that was sort of based puritanically, based in not talking about sexual activity, which is how all this has been allowed to go on unchecked for generations, right? Also, we accept the old myths about rape. We remember back in the 80s, we would talk to our kids about stranger danger, which mm-hmm. is a good thing to talk about because there are horrible, creepy strangers out there. But for victims under age 18, about 93% of those victims are hurt by somebody that they know. So if we're only talking to them about stranger danger, and we're not talking to them about the fact that nobody gets to touch their body without permission, we have failed our kids.
You give us a warning of sorts that the account of rape is at hand in the book. There are three poems called It, capital I, capital T, which sort of flagged it for me. One phrase really screams out, broken children can see each other from miles away. It's a really keen observation, but is it one you would have dared write as a much younger writer?
I think that part of I've just had such an incredible life of opportunities. And in the last 20 years, all those high schools, I've spoken to over a million high school students, all those high schools that I've been fortunate enough to visit have granted me the opportunity to observe things. I don't know that 20 years ago I would have been able to say that, but having spent so much time with teenagers, I get and at all kinds of high schools in every single state, I've seen the kids that are occupying the spaces that I did when I was a broken kid. I can see them a mile off. And it's really helped me understand what kids who don't have responsible, loving, trustworthy adults in their life, what they have to do to survive. And one of the things they do is they find each other. We are hardwired to create family if we don't have functional families of our own.
So we'll go find them. We'll find other collections of people to
act
like a family.
We're going to find our people. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Lori Hulse Anderson is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is called Shout, and it's a sort of a 20-year follow-up to Speak. You can join the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Your father, as you report in the book, struggled with alcohol, didn't lose all perception. You write about him hearing something in your voice after the rape. Did you ever consider telling your parents about it?
Oh, no. That was, and the main reason I would never have considered that was because of my dad. Let's be really clear. My father was an extraordinary man who loved his family profoundly. My father was also a traumatized veteran who turned to alcohol to help him deal with almost insurmountable psychological pain. My father also knew how to use a gun. And my biggest fear is that if I told him about this boy who had raped me, that he would, in a stupor and while drunk, hunt down the boy and shoot him. And then that would be my fault and my dad would be in jail. And I was terrified that he was going to do that. So that's why I didn't tell anybody. When a strange thing happened a few weeks after that boy raped me, the boy was killed. He was drunk. He was playing chicken with cars. People used to get drunk back then and lay down on the road and dare the driver to swerve or they would roll out of the way. And it was a dark country road and the car didn't see him. And I told my dad that a friend of mine had died. That's how I classified that boy. And my dad looked at me really, he heard something in my voice. And so there was that moment when I could have said something and I didn't dare. but Daddy went with me to the funeral, and he held me as I sobbed. I was sobbing because I was so relieved that the boy was dead. I was afraid that he was going to tell everybody at school. And this is a brand new high school. We had moved again a few weeks before, and I didn't want to start out with a girl as a reputation for as a sexual conquest. So I was so happy he was gone.
So you confided in no one, ultimately, it sounds like, at least not in that point in your life.
No, I didn't tell anybody. I didn't tell anybody for 23 years.
And 13, going on 14, is about when life really changes. And I wonder, Lori, can you separate after all this time how you changed, how you would have changed naturally versus how you changed because of being raped?
That's really, really tough to unwind. I'm not sure that anybody's capable of doing that. Ninth grade was a disastrous year for me, mostly because I was high all year. But in 10th grade and 11th grade, that's when I began to choose healthier alternatives. I had one of the gym teachers encouraged me to become an athlete, so I was on sports teams. That was super good for me. And I also wound up joining the International Club because I enjoy learning about other cultures and languages. Both of those things combined, it helped me transition from being a broken kid into a kid who was putting herself back together. I suspect sports and languages are things that I would have been interested in anyways. It just took me a little bit longer to get there.
God bless that short gym teacher, you write.
Indeed.
So you don't think you would have gotten interested in sports if she hadn't said, hey, you know, you got the build for sports. You should do this.
Not back then, no. Yeah. I was a lost kid. I really was. And I'm a big woman. I was a big teenage girl, too. And I don't think that gym teacher necessarily noticed that I was in pain or that I was struggling emotionally, but she did see somebody who could take up some space on a court. And I wound up becoming a shot put thrower. My nickname in high school was Moose. So you find the space that you need to occupy, I guess. It was a lot of fun.
Moose, really?
Moose, really.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Yikes. So you write, I could only fix myself, and that line stands alone by itself in the poem in which it's offered. You mentioned already why you couldn't go to your father. Was your mother of any, I mean, did you consider telling her?
Never. My mother never talked to me about sex.
Really?
When I got my period for the first time, she handed me a box of tampons and told me that the instructions were inside. But my mother also had a mother that never talked to her about sex. I did get the message, the really twisted wrong, but the old message that as a girl, as a woman, I was somehow responsible for men's reactions to me. Therefore, it was my responsibility to dress modestly. And I did complain to her once when somebody had grabbed my body, and she said, well, you shouldn't have been there. You shouldn't have been wearing that. This notion that women and girls are somehow magically responsible for controlling the hands and thoughts of men and boys is so harmful. And it takes the responsibility off the people who ultimately are the ones who hurt other people the most. Certainly men and boys can be victims of sexual violence, and we have to always recognize that and make sure that there's room and space for them to come forward if they're comfortable to talk about what happened, as well as everybody who identifies outside that traditional binary gender status. But the overwhelming number of perpetrators of sexual violence are men and boys. And we have to make sure that they know from the early age what the rules of consent are. There's a lot of really wonderful but confused teenage boys out there. Because their parents can talk to them now about, well, you need to wear a condom when you're going to have sex. And they'll give them that one talk. But most parents cannot conceive of their son as being a rapist, especially since so many people are still operating with the model that the rapist is the bad guy in the bushes with a gun. And they say, well, that can't be my son.
Hmm.
So few parents actually go to the trouble to explain to their sons that consent has to be sober, informed, ongoing, and enthusiastic every single time. It's not, did the person say no to you? The rule is, did your partner say yes, and yes, and yes? And if you don't have that yes, you keep your clothes on, and you don't touch.
So by the time of your rape, the message was already out there in the world. It was coming from some quarters. Maybe it wasn't widely accepted then that people don't encourage people to rape them by the way they dress or who they hang out with or any of that stuff.
Well, but I disagree. My rape happened in 1975.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all about policing the way women acted, dressed, and moved.
But feminism was already several years old by that time.
Well, several years old. maybe I don't think it had reached Syracuse, New York yet.
Oh, that's the issue, where you were. And so. But then how many times did you have to hear it once it finally began to be said a lot before you got to change your own view of things?
I think when I got to college, I think that's very common for a lot of people, is that you absorb the messages of your community, your culture, your family systems as a high school student. But if you're privileged enough to go to college, I went to community college first and then was given a good scholarship to get to Georgetown. That's when you begin to think critically. It's also the place where your mind has evolved, your intellect has evolved. So you can begin to question the messages you were given and figure out what you believe in.
Lori Hulse Anderson is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Shout, her free verse book of being raped at age 13 and the trail leading on from that time. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange with more of Lori Hulse Anderson, and you can join us by phone and email when we return to the Exchange in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Lori Hulse Anderson, who wowed a lot of people and opened a lot of eyes 20 years ago with the book Speak. It was a nonfiction young adult work about, a fiction rather, young adult work about someone who had been raped and didn't know how to communicate that information. 20 years later, Lori Hulse Anderson talks about her own rape at age 13 in the book Shout, a book of free verse, nonfiction. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We have Marie in Springfield called in, didn't stay on the line, but she wanted to go back to the story about your father and the fact that he had abused your mother earlier in the marriage, and asks the question, how could he love her and hurt her?
Well, my dad was, the night that he hurt her, very angry. It was early in their marriage, and he was very drunk. And what I was told is that after he sobered up, he was suicidal, looking at what he had done to her. He never touched her again, but they also didn't talk about it.
Hmm. And that was something that did either of them ever talk about with you?
My mother did eventually, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Daddy never did.
Was it very late in her life?
Yeah. That's when she was beginning to talk about it. And that's when she began to talk a little bit about her sorrow over all of her miscarriages.
Mm-hmm.
And how much that really, really, I don't think she ever stopped thinking about those children.
Five miscarriages, you said, right?
Five miscarriages, all of them boys.
And did you know those stories growing up, or was that something also that she didn't tell you about? I mean, did she talk about it at all until late
in
life?
Well, here we come back, circle back to my dad again. My father enjoyed his daughters. I mean, we were a lovely family, but my dad really wanted sons. And I think there was a part of him that always blamed my mother for the fact that all those miscarried children were boys, and that he didn't, that old, very inappropriate, inaccurate science that somehow the woman gets to decide, or her body determines if it's a male or a female that's born. And so, yeah, she was blamed for that too.
Wow. So you talked about how things changed for you over the course of high school. You spent freshman year as a stoner, turned into a bit of a jock, it sounds like, from sophomore year on, and then went to Denmark as an exchange student. How much did that open your eyes?
Oh, that saved my life, frankly. It was the best thing that ever happened to me. My home was not really a fun place to be in those days. Dad wasn't working. He was suicidal. My mother was working every hour possible to keep the electricity turned on and keep a roof over our heads. And all I wanted to do was to run away. I wasn't thinking of what I was running to. I was just running from the dysfunction and the sadness and the pain. So I applied to be a foreign exchange student, the American Field Service. And in that program in those days, you couldn't say where you wanted to go. I just said, I'll go anywhere. And I wound up being sent to a wonderful family, the best family in the world, on a pig farm in Denmark. And I lived with them for 13 months.
I wondered how you described coming home, and you did not disappoint. The phrase is commence reentry sequence. What was that like?
Boy, that was strange. It's interesting looking back. I see my time as Denmark as I literally learned a new language. I learned to speak Danish, but I also learned the language of myself. That was where I got to start over completely. It was such a gift, such a privilege. But then I had to go home, and obviously I was quite a changed, much more mature person. I had lived in a healthy family system for a year. I observed a community, Danish culture, that was based on kindness and cooperation and just a spirit of caring for each other that I had not experienced up to that point in the U.S. And then I got to go back to everything, which looked very different to me when I came back. And I think I was more able to appreciate the love that was in my family of origin, my biological family, than I had been when I left. That distance that had been created by my time abroad was very healthy for me.
So obviously you're growing and gaining strength. Your parents are coming apart at this point, though. You were making a life bit by bit. You write of your wounds scarring over, but were you ever, Lori, not aware of them?
No. Just like if you've ever been in a car accident, and no matter how much PT you go through, sometimes you still walk with a limp or it'll ache. I still have moments. I now have my therapist on speed dial. Every once in a while, I don't go regularly to therapy. I'm in a pretty healthy place. But every once in a while, I need to go back in for a tune-up.
So I want to come back to the things that spurred the creation of Shout. You already talked about the rage you felt and exactly where you were standing in New York City in 2017 when you said, I got to write this book. Here's a poem from well into the book that we clipped off of YouTube.
Me, too weak to fight him off. Me, too scared, silent. Me, too, disassembled by the guy who misunderstood. Mistaken, mention my name to my misery siblings as we support, report, reveal the violence they desperately want us to conceal. Me to be stronger, you to stand taller, we to shout louder than they thought we could.
Lori Hulse Anderson reading one of the poems from Shout. So earlier in the book and earlier in this discussion, we talked about things that were considered acceptable in 1975. We've since identified they're not. But what goes through your mind when you think we're still saying they're not nearly 50 years later?
Well, because quite frankly, men have controlled many of the power structures in this country since European men came to these shores 400 years ago. This is a culture that's based in dominance. We reward boys and men for exhibiting anger and rage and behaving in a dominant fashion, which is why middle school and high school can be so fraught for so many boys who are the victims of bullies and bullying. And even though the laws are changing, having to get consent, I'm on the radio talking to you about this, which would have been unthinkable in 1975, we still have millions and millions of victims of sexual violence in our country. And the old attitudes, attitudes change faster or slower sometimes than understanding. And when you walk into a room and you give a presentation and then you have women and some men lining up afterwards in tears, one by one, to share their stories with you. And they haven't felt like they had permission to share their stories because they've never seen somebody talk about this. That is what motivates me to get out of bed every morning and keep doing this work.
So what must that be like to be the receiver of that, though, when people are coming up and telling you things they've never told anyone? Are they telling you because you wrote a book that really resonated with them?
It's a tremendous honor. It's a gift. When somebody trusts you enough to share something like that, what that means is that they are relying on me to be a kind, responsible person, and that's what I'm trying to be. Some people say, oh, isn't that hard? No, what's really hard is to have to go through this and to feel like you can't talk about it. When somebody comes to you and wants to share their story, I think the listener, listening is as important as shouting sometimes, the listener needs to honor the struggle that that person's been enduring and to sit quietly without trying to fix them, without gasping or having an overtly emotional reaction. Just give them the space they need to share what they need to say, to share. The RAIN website, Rape, Abuse, Incest National Network, has wonderful resources for people who love somebody who has been hurt by sexual violence about how to listen, how to help that person get help and support. That's a good skill set for all of us to learn.
We are pretty lousy listeners as a population, aren't we?
Yeah, we are.
So, I mean, and I, because I hear everything you're saying here, because we can all relate to these situations where you just wanted to help somebody and fix them. Like, have you tried this? Have you tried that? And that's not what they need.
I think that that rush to offer suggestions has a lot to do with our personal discomfort at listening to this story. And taking deep breaths help. Also recognizing that for as uncomfortable as you may be listening to this, the person who's telling you has endured way, way more pain. And sometimes the way to be a super good friend or an honorable human being is to sit in that discomfort and allow this person to disclose without feeling judged or criticized or without you rushing in to put a Band-Aid on something that needs stitches.
So once the person has had the chance to say what they needed to say, particularly when you're meeting people for the first time because they wanted you to sign their book, where do you guide them from there?
The first question I always ask is, do you feel safe in your life? Because that person needs to identify for me, you know, do I need to help them find law enforcement or somebody who, if they're living with their abuser or something like that, that's a much graver situation than somebody who's finally disclosing something that happened when they were in college, 5 years earlier, different set of circumstances, different relationship with the attacker. I always am sharing the information about RAIN.org with everybody I talk to. RAIN has been out there for 25 years now. It is the number one hotline for victims of sexual violence. They have trained personnel, volunteers on the hotline. They have an anonymous chat line. And they have a dedicated hotline for victims who are members of the military because of the special judicial and other challenges facing military members who've been hurt within the service by other service members. So RAIN is my go-to resource.
Let me guide people there now. It's RAINN, RAIN with two N's for National Network, RAIN.org. And the number is 800-656-HOPE or 800-656-4673. That's the RAIN operation at RAIN.org. Lori, I found a YouTube clip from 5 years ago in which you talk about being asked by a younger reader if you're okay, given the content of your books. The question kind of stuck with you, didn't it?
It did. I've had kids come up to me after presentations sobbing because the one girl in particular, her sister had been raped, and then the sister turned to drugs to anesthetize herself from all the pain, and the sister's life went off the tracks. And they didn't know that you could be okay after going through this. And that's something for us to really keep in mind, that our children need us to model what it looks like to be a survivor. They need us to be honest with them about the threats and the possibilities that bad things could happen are out there. To cling to the notion that bad things only happen to bad people is childish and damaging. We all know that bad things happen to good people all the time. And so instead of, some false notion of innocence that some people try to maintain for their kids and their teenagers, we actually have a responsibility to be honest with them about what they can face out there and to help them develop resilience, because that's going to get them through the hard things.
So here again, we're talking about rape of a teenager, and this is the center occurrence in your nonfiction book, Shout. It's a memoir. But you know, since we still keep getting this, you know, I remember a discussion just the other day about you know, the Kavanaugh hearings, for example, for his confirmation to the Supreme Court, and people kind of blowing it off as like, well, you know, drunk teenagers, that sort of thing. I mean, I just wonder what you were feeling when you were hearing those sorts of blow-offs.
Well, when I watched the Kavanaugh hearings, that was the closest I ever came to throwing a television set through a hotel window. You talk about, there's a lot of angry women in America because of that. Women who saw themselves in Christine Blasey Ford. And when we talk about boys being boys, what that really is code for is that boys and men get to touch women's bodies without permission, because somehow their need to be dominant or to be abusive or to be cruel is somehow more important than the woman's need to be safe. So that's what we're talking about when we're using that phrase. If you think that that's an appropriate thing, would you like your son to be abused sexually by another man? If that's that's boys being boys too. And if that sounds like it's not a good thing, then we have to recognize that we owe all of our children, all of our fellow citizens, the courtesy, the bottom line right to agency over their own bodies, and to pick and choose whom they touch, who touches them, and under what circumstances every single time.
Lori, we have to go. How long did it take to write Shout? It sounds like it kind of wrote itself in some ways.
Well, it wrote itself in a few months. On the other hand, it took a lifetime to learn the lessons.
Indeed. The book is called Shout, The True Story of a Survivor Who Refused to Be Silenced. It is Lori Hall Sanderson telling the story of her own rape at age 13 in free verse. Again, I want to let people know before we go about the RAIN National Network, rain.org, RAINN.org, 800-656-4673. Lori Hall Sanderson, thank you very much.
Thanks for listening.
All right, take care.